Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Evidence of Russia's role in Thursday's crash of a Malaysian airliner is cited. In Kenya, a bus attack results in multiple deaths. I'm Vincent Bruce reporting from Washington. Ukraine's counterintelligence chief, Vitaly Nade, says his country has compelling evidence that shows Russians played a role in shooting down a Malaysian Airlines flight over a separatist-controlled region near the Russian border.
To operate Buk-M1, you need to have military education and to be well-trained. We know for sure that the team was Russian. There were Russian citizens operating Buk-M1, and they came from the territory of Russian Federation together with the missile launcher.
Nada spoke to reporters during a Saturday news conference. Thursday's missile strike killed all 298 people on board the plane. Ukraine also has accused Russia of assisting pro-Russian separatists in destroying evidence at the crash site. Russia has not commented on Ukraine's claims. Malaysian Transport Minister Liao Chiong Lai, traveling to Ukraine to join officials who are assisting in the crash probe, told reporters before leaving for Kyiv, the Malaysia Airlines flight was on its proper path when it was downed.
It followed a route which was set out by the international aviation authorities, approved by Eurocontrol, and used by hundreds of other aircraft. It flew at an altitude set and deemed safe by the local air traffic control, and it never strayed into restricted airspace.
Liao said vital evidence of the crash site had been tampered with. He called it a betrayal of the lives lost in the disaster. Kenya's Red Cross said gunmen opened fire on a bus Friday, killing at least 7 people. The aid group says the attack happened near Witu, a town in Lamu County. Al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for the assault. The militants said the attack was carried out in response to the government's assertion that all the areas that have recently been subjected to attacks are now secured. More details on all of these stories at voanews.com. Israeli soldiers say they have repelled a cross-border tunnel raid and uncovered more than a dozen tunnels into Israel, while Palestinian medics say more Israeli airstrikes and shelling have killed 25 more Palestinians. Palestinian officials on Saturday said at least 325 Palestinians have died since July 8th when Israel expanded its airstrikes in Gaza in an attempt to stop rocket fire into Israel. A farming town in northeastern Nigeria was raided by gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants. Dozens of people reportedly were killed in the attack Friday. Heather Murdoch has details from Abuja.
Residents say gunmen stormed the remote town of Damboa in southern Borno State around 5 a.m. Friday. The attack was one of several in the area over the past 2 weeks. Witnesses say by the time this one was over, half the buildings left standing after the last attack were burned down. The townspeople had little chance against the militants. Some villagers say their only weapons are sticks and locally made obsolete Dane guns. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In Pakistan, a U.S. drone strike reportedly has killed at least a dozen militants in the volatile North Waziristan region. The Pakistani military is engaged in a counterterrorism offensive in the area that could include targeting extremists involved in deadly cross-border raids in Afghanistan. Aya School reports from Islamabad.
Local intelligence officials say the pre-dawn attack took place in the Datta Khel area, where a U.S. drone fired several missiles into a sprawling militant camp. Most of the dead were said to be fighters of the outlawed Pakistani Taliban and its Uzbek allies. Repeated U.S. drone strikes in North Waziristan are reported to have killed around 50 people since mid-June, when Pakistan's military launched a major offensive against local and foreign extremists entrenched in the mountainous border region. Officials in Islamabad say around 500 militants have been killed and the military has lost more than 24 soldiers. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A UN set of human rights experts have expressed concern about the widespread violence and discrimination to which women in conflict-ridden Central African Republic and Syria are subjected. CAR and Syria are 2 of 8 countries examined by the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which monitors states' compliance to existing rules. More on all of these stories at our website, voanews.com, 24 hours a day. I'm Vincent Bruce in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Fraser.
War crimes, crimes against humanity, state terrorism, and systematic human rights violations are being committed by Israel against the Palestinian people.
The UN Secretary General expresses alarm over the continuing unrest in the Middle East.
If we do want to eliminate HIV by 2030, which is a fairly ambitious target, but I think it is a realistic target.
New reports of HIV and AIDS infection stabilizing worldwide.
We've tried to make sure that the services will be available across all handsets and across all mobile channels. And by that we mean SMS, UCC, MobiSite, application.
And we'll look at how digital technology will help improve maternal and child health in sub-Saharan Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon headed to the Middle East on Saturday to try to find a way to end the violence between Israel and Hamas militants. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
UN Political Chief Jeffrey Feltman told the UN Security Council during an emergency meeting Friday that Ban Ki-moon is heading to the Middle East, though he did not give details about his visit.
The Secretary General is prepared to do his part. He will leave for the region tomorrow to express solidarity with Israelis and Palestinians and to help them in coordination with regional and international actors end the violence and find a way forward.
Mr. Ban expressed his alarm on Thursday when Israeli forces launched their ground incursion into Gaza and Hamas resumed rocket fire into Israel. The UN chief said he regretted that despite his repeated urgings to seek calm, an already dangerous conflict had escalated further. Palestinian envoy Riyad Mansour read the names of dozens of Palestinian civilians who have been killed, the majority from Israeli airstrikes. They ranged in age from 5 months to 80 years old.
War crimes, crimes against humanity, state terrorism, and systematic human rights violations are being committed by Israel against the Palestinian people.
He said if the Security Council fails to end these violations and protect the Palestinians, they would have no choice but to go to UN and other international courts. The Palestinian leadership has repeatedly said it would consider joining the Treaty of the International Criminal Court so it could refer the situation under occupation to the court. He also called on the Council to adopt a resolution condemning Israel's military action in Gaza, demand its immediate end, and protect the Palestinian people. Ambassador Ron Prosser said Israel was left with no choice but to launch its incursion into Gaza.
A few hours ago, the Israeli Defense Forces entered Gaza to restore the sustained quiet to the people of Israel while degrading Hamas's terror capabilities. We did everything in our power to avoid this. Prime Minister Netanyahu made the courageous decision to accept every ceasefire offered, even as the people of Israel were under attack. But Hamas rejected every overture to restore the quiet.
Ambassador Samantha Power said the United States is deeply concerned about the rocket attacks by Hamas and the dangerous escalation of hostilities and their impact on civilians on both sides. She said President Barack Obama spoke with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Friday morning to reaffirm U.S. support for Israel's right to defend itself. She said Washington also supports Egypt's ceasefire proposal, and Secretary of State John Kerry is ready to return to the region following more consultations in order to try to bring it about. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
In another development, UN human rights experts are expressing concern about the widespread violence and discrimination to which women in conflict-ridden Central African Republic and Syria are subjected. CAR and Syria are two of eight countries examined by the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which monitors states' compliance to existing rules. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Members of the committee say countries at peace often miss the deadline for submitting reports regarding their implementation of the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And so they were surprised when delegations from two conflict-ridden countries, the Central African Republic and Syria, arrived on time to argue their cases before the 23 experts. The committee says a six-member delegation from the CAR's transitional government described the profound crisis into which the country was plunged. It spoke of forced marriage, sexual slavery, rape, and other forms of sexual violence against women perpetrated by armed combatants and civilians. The delegation lamented the impunity with which these crimes were being perpetrated, but said the government was helpless to do anything because it lacked a judicial system and all other functioning institutions. Committee member and rapporteur for the Central African Republic, Patricia Schultz, says it was surrealistic listening to this horrific litany of abuse.
It was absolutely not normal, but we took their presence there as a commitment of the provisional, the transitional authorities to try and address the urgent needs of women and girls in this country. I mean, they're completely aware, and we were completely aware, of the very particular situation they are in.
Schultz says the CAR is in a state of collapse, and the kind of recommendations normally given to states at peace to end discrimination against women make little sense in this context. Nevertheless, she says the committee has urged the delegation to give priority to ending violence against women and impunity, and to peace and security. In this regard, she says, the experts told the delegation the government should engage women at every level of dialogue in efforts to reach a political agreement to end the conflict. A similar recommendation was made in regard to women in Syria. A large, high-level delegation, including several women, presented the government's report. Committee member and rapporteur on Syria, Nala Haidar, tells VOA the committee is very concerned about attacks against civilian populations and the denial of humanitarian aid to besieged areas by all parties to the conflict. She says the experts grilled the delegation on such issues as enforced disappearances and arbitrary arrests of women and girls, and about physical abuse and sexual violence by government forces against women activists. She says the committee is particularly concerned about the marginalization of women's voices in peace negotiations.
We have definitely also put a lot of emphasis on women, peace and security, because everyone knows that Syrian women voices were not properly integrated and heard in the peace talks that took place in Switzerland. We felt that the opportunity of addressing other women's views, other political views of women, and very important competencies of Syrian women that could make a difference in the negotiation and for the future of Syria was not addressed.
Haidar says the committee also addressed root causes of some of the problems in Syria. She notes the experts are concerned that Syria's new constitution places women under religious rule, a situation that did not exist under the previous constitution. She says the experts touched on problems of trafficking and exploitation of women in conflict. The committee has asked the Syrian delegation to come back in a year to respond to these and other concerns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations AIDS Agency, UNAIDS, says new HIV infections and deaths from AIDS are decreasing, making it possible to control the epidemic by the year 2030 and eventually end it in every region, in every country. The agency says the number of people infected with HIV was stabilizing at about 35 million worldwide. The epidemic has killed 39 million of the 78 million people infected since the 1980s. As Lenore Madu reports for VOA from Washington, the World Health Organization is warning that its goal to end AIDS by 2030 will not be reached if the people most at risk continue to not receive the health services they need.
The global progress on the HIV response is in jeopardy. This is due to failure to provide adequate HIV services for key groups such as men who have sex with men, people in prison, and people who inject drugs. This finding and others were published in the World Health Organization's latest report titled Consolidated Guidelines on HIV Prevention, Diagnosis, Treatment and Care for Key Populations. Gottfried Henschel is the director of the HIV Department of the WHO.
If we do want to eliminate HIV by 2030, which is a fairly ambitious target, but I think it is a realistic target, it will be realistic only if we manage to focus much more strongly and much more effectively on key populations.
Key populations and their sex partners account for as much as 51% of new infections in Nigeria and more than 27% in Mozambique. The WHO recommends that, in addition to using condoms, men who have sex with men should also take antiretroviral AIDS drugs for prevention. This is known as pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. But observers say in many countries, key populations are left out of national HIV plans.
Stigma, discrimination, violence, punitive laws and social, legal and social environments increase HIV vulnerability, and punitive environments have been shown to limit the availability and access to services by this population.
The WHO says there is an urgent need to address the problem. Access to healthcare is poorest in countries where prostitution, homosexual intercourse, and the use of drugs are illegal. Individuals fear threats of detention if they visit health centers.
The first step in combating these the negative environments that key populations face is the understanding that health systems and healthcare workers have a duty of care, and that anybody from whatever background they have requires respectful services, and that's the duty of healthcare providers.
The WHO report, released ahead of the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia, next week, says by the end of 2013, around 13 million people worldwide were taking AIDS drug treatment, a 20% drop in HIV-related death between 2009 and 2012.
That was Lenore Madu reporting for VOA. In other news, a new initiative that aims to improve maternal and child health and nutrition in sub-Saharan Africa is being launched in September 2014 using digital technology. Gemalto, a digital security company, is partnering with a mobile telecommunications association called GSMA. Together, they're providing support to over 15 million pregnant women and mothers with children under 5 years old. VOA's Kim Lewis reports from Washington.
GSMA's Pan-African M-Health Initiative, also known as PAMI, a mobile system to improve child health and nutrition, has brought together a partnership of digital and telecommunications corporations. They will provide vital information and health services to hard-to-reach population groups in sub-Saharan Africa. Craig Frederick, Director of Health at GSMA in Cape Town, South Africa, says this means greater access to health care for pregnant moms and women across Africa.
We know that there's a huge penetration of mobile across Africa, but we also understand that a lot of the very vulnerable women don't have access to those phones. We know that the access is likely through someone in their household or family member. So we've tried to make sure that the services will be available across all handsets and across all mobile channels. And by that we mean SMS, USSD, Mobi site, application. So really stretching across the continuum of basic phone through to feature phone and then onto the higher-end smartphones.
Jeremy Osborne is the business development director for Gemalto, one of the first leading partners in what they describe as an ambitious undertaking. He explains how the Smart Message service will work in African countries.
The Smart Message service is an interactive messaging solution which uses SMS as a bearer and creates an enhanced user interface. And the important part is that this runs on all handsets because it's based on the SIM card itself. What this means is you now have a tool that is very convenient to use for either surveys or promoting services. So in a case like this, you can use a tool like this to provide very effective access to mHealth services or gain insight from the population on mHealth-related matters.
Fredericks of GSMA says the services are predicated on working with partners in each of the targeted sub-Saharan African countries.
We work with local health authorities and regulators and health providers to make sure that the content and services that the vulnerable women and children will be receiving are contextualized, localized, and available in their given language of choice.
In addition, the GSMA representative highlights the partnerships have allowed for simplicity for the end user.
Essentially, what we've seen in the industry is that the price and availability of services is not what it should be. And so we've managed to secure the commitments of MTN and Samsung, Gibraltar, and other partners to effectively make these services free of charge to the end user. So making sure that the most vulnerable, hard-to-reach population groups have access at a very affordable and sustainable rate.
Gibraltar executive Jeremy Osborne says they are delighted to be able to see how their technology is being used in Africa to provide vital services for African women and children.
We have such a strong presence in Africa thanks to the numerous mobile operators that procure services from us, SIM cards and services and such. So it puts us in a wonderful position to really assist the operators and all the members of this initiative to really deploy a broad range of mobile health services.
For the initial phase of the project, which will be launched in September, there are 7 countries participating: Ivory Coast, Ghana, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Uganda, and Zambia. Local healthcare workers will obtain vital information from mothers and mothers-to-be in each country and register them for the long-term project. They will also provide them with mobile phones and healthcare services free of charge. I'm Kim Lewis, reporting from Washington.
In Malawi, almost one-third of new HIV cases occur in women under the age of 30. AIDS campaigners say this is partly the result of the early introduction of young girls to sexual activity in traditional coming-of-age ceremonies. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Malawi's demographic and health survey shows that 20% of young girls in the Southern African country become sexually active before the age of 13, and many of them do this with limited knowledge of safe sex. AIDS campaigners blame this on cultural and traditional practices in which girls are sent to special initiation camps where they are sometimes encouraged to have sex to transition into adulthood. Chief Joe is a senior traditional leader in Malawi's southern district of Mangochi, where the practice is rampant. Joe says the practice has exposed girls to high-risk HIV infection because the people who have sex with them are usually older men who also sleep with several girls in the camp. Girls Empowerment Network is a local NGO in Malawi that works to discourage girls from engaging in sex at a young age. Communications advisor Joyce Nkandawire says another danger of the traditional practice is that the girls become addicted to sex.
So once you introduce a girl to first sexual encounter, I mean, they go back and they do it because they have done it at the initiation camp.
Nkandawire says as a result, most of the girls become pregnant and they drop out of school. Chief Joey and Nkandawire says several interventions are being taken to address problems associated with early sex among girls. Joey says he has been teaching initiation camp counselors about the dangers of encouraging girls to have early sexual intercourse. He says together with other traditional leaders in the district, he has set up bylaws which aim to curb sexual activity among girls.
As leaders, we have designed bylaws whereby all school-going age should go to school, and if they get pregnant, we have got some fine which we have designed. The parent is asked to pay a goat if his or her girl child has been impregnated while in school.
Nkandawire says her organization is pushing for the modification of the initiation camps.
We are trying to change the syllabus of initiation. Actually, we would want to replace initiation with the summer camps, where girls are told how to behave like girls, and I encourage them to stay in school and not introduce them into womanhood. No.
The Malawi government's coordinating arm for the HIV activities, the National AIDS Commission, says it is supporting several initiatives that seek to transform traditional practices that lead to HIV infection among girls. Linje Manyozo is a specialist in a social and behavioral change intervention for the commission.
We have educational projects where we work with traditional leaders, we work with social leaders, opinion makers in the community to ensure that harmful cultural practices are no longer practiced.
The government is currently implementing a five-year national HIV-AIDS strategy it launched in 2012. The HIV strategy also provides life skills education for young girls to make them understand their rights and become self-empowered. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The Overseas Development Institute, ODI, and Kaleidoscope Trust quite recently hosted a conference to explore whether international aid can play a role in defending lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, LGBT rights in developing countries. I spoke with the director of ODI, Kevin Watkins, who outlined what foreign aid donors can do to support LGBT rights in developing countries.
Well, the main thing that foreign aid donors can do, I think, is two things. To support groups who are making a difference on the ground, that is LGBT groups, broader alliances that are supporting them, human rights groups, and others in civil society who are working together for what are, in the end, fundamental human rights that we all believe in and we should all support. I also think that the donor community has to do the tough job. They have to engage with governments. They have to engage with political debates in countries that are uncomfortable. And that means using the full panoply of instruments and resources available.
LGBT rights in developing countries seem to be non-existent. Do you think that governments are actively considering LGBT rights?
Well, I think it's important not to draw blanket conclusions about this. It's certainly true that in many developing countries, there is a lot of anti-LGBT legislation on the statute books. In many cases, the legislation isn't actually used. In other countries, Uganda and Nigeria would be standout examples of this, where there is recent legislation that has been enacted, which is, I think, well beyond the scope of what most of us would understand as respect for fundamental human rights. You know, the idea that you can suffer lifetime imprisonment as a result of your sexuality, I think, is profoundly and fundamentally unacceptable. The idea that citizens have an obligation, as they now do in Uganda, to report on people who they suspect being of an LGBT orientation is unacceptable. You know, the idea that as a member of a group of consenting adults who come together on the basis of their sexual orientation, this is a criminal activity, that is unacceptable. So I think there are cases like that which are quite extreme, and there are other cases where there are very active national debates going on. You know, it's easy to pick on individual governments and to look at what appears to be quite horrible legislation, but beneath the surface, this is a very contested area, and there are groups who are working for change. And I think the challenge is to, you know, for the international community to support those groups, to engage with governments, you know, who could go one way or the other, and in other cases, to apply an appropriate level of sanction against individuals and governments who are responsible for some of the most egregious legislation in this area.
I know we shouldn't be drawing a blanket statement regarding this issue, but is it fair to say that developing countries in Africa are more focused on ending hunger, providing access to affordable health care, and ending civil conflicts as opposed to supporting LGBT rights?
Well, you know, if governments are serious about combating life-threatening diseases, if governments are serious about combating poverty, if they're serious about extending educational opportunity to all of their citizens, they won't be discriminating against the minority group that is of an LGBT orientation. It's a fair question, but these are not policy objectives that are in conflict. You know, it's not that you can be in favor of LGBT rights but disinterested in poverty. I would argue that if you're not interested in supporting LGBT rights, you're not going to succeed in combating poverty. You're not going to succeed in providing treatments for the victims of HIV/AIDS. You're not going to succeed in drawing on the talents of your young people. And you know, that surely has to be wrong. You know, this is really about expanding opportunity for all people.
Kevin Watkins is the director of the Overseas Development Institute. He spoke with me from London, United Kingdom. This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Still to come in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Crossing there to share. Yeah, the BSC is your man, so Rosu. Was to bend your da papa demona. Ah, yeah, yeah, the way. Tasso, boom, okay. Some kind of fool, and you also won't have fair. Same way, Bruni, where we stop spying and up. Pray for me in Pombo. Oh, Baba, yeah, your name, what he ain't he woke on woman to get lost. Ain't no cana, so you could look.
Bad bottom, yeah. One now watch me, bad me. come if you want change. The money said no, the power. Or the power to junk in this. Guys, a friend in need is always a friend indeed. Guys, a friend in need is always a friend indeed. Yeah, when I watch training, bam, man.
Music from the continent. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington, D.C. Here's Dr. Yang.
Welcome, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to share my reflections on American policy towards Africa. Right now, the clock is ticking. The summit between President Obama and the African leaders is forthcoming. In August, the 4th of August to the end of that week, all the African leaders are set to come here, except those who are not invited. The message is loud and clear, and people are very much aware of this. Today, I want to really discuss the summit. It's significance for President Obama and how the African leaders are going to look at this event in terms of African-American relations. Let's go back to legacy, legacy, legacy. All those who are talking about President Obama and his legacy cannot discount the impact of this summit for his legacy. Three points come to mind immediately. And many of the scholars and university analysts writing for different places are talking about Obama and his legacy. And of course, most people look at his legacy with regard to America. But those of us who are in African studies are looking at his legacy with respect to Africa. John F. Kennedy, in 1960, got elected. In 61, he gave his inaugural address. And of course, one thing that came out of that inaugural address was the Peace Corps volunteers for America. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That message was loud and clear to many young Americans. People we now call the baby boomers, many of them listened to that call, and their legacies, their contribution to America is loud and clear throughout the world, from Latin America to Asia to Africa, and even to the former Soviet Union now, many of them still benefit from their legacy. Now, when we come to President Obama and the clock is ticking, AGOA is going to be number one. The African leaders and all those people who are interested in Africa have devoted a great deal of their time to AGOA. Recently, in Washington, D.C., the African diplomatic community and the State Department honored the ambassador of Mauritius, who has played a very important role in championing AGOA. Of course, the Mauritians have vested interest in AGOA because they are one of the major beneficiaries of AGOA. So when they celebrated the ambassador of Mauritius recently, they were doing juice to him because he was a diplomat of Mauritius in other parts of the world before coming to the major assignment in D.C. So AGOA is the big issue, and all the American diplomats who work with him appreciated that. So when we look at the clock is ticking, we want to see to what extent the Obama administration is going to preserve AGOA. We go back to Bill Clinton's tenure in office. So as we move towards August and the summit, we look at the summit and its impact. So the Obama administration will have to do a lot of juggling with the Republicans who control the House to make sure that AGOA is not dead, that AGOA is alive. But then something else must come out, because Obama has already introduced Power Africa, which is now attracting a lot of attention among the corporate council members who are involved in Africa. Besides Mauritius, Nigeria and Angola are major beneficiaries of AGOA. They benefited differently from other African countries like Senegal, Mali, Niger, and other cotton-producing countries going all the way to Sudan. Those countries were not able to bargain successfully to get their products, such as cotton and other much agricultural products from their area, to get the same benefits, because AGOA was trying to ask the Africans to engage in what Kwame Nkrumah was advised by the West Indian economist to promote import substitution. Ghana tried for a while before Nkrumah was overthrown, but import substitution never advanced in Africa until AGOA challenged the Africans to make sure that they can export to the United States. The beneficiaries were Mauritius, where the Indians and the Chinese and other enterprising countries were able to produce manufactured products, just like in Bangladesh, to bring to the United States. If you have any doubt about this and you're an American, just go to the American shopping malls and look at made in Mauritius, made in Qatar, made in Bangladesh, and made in Lesotho to have the evidence. And that's the way it is. So if we are talking about legacy for President Obama and African summit, we are looking for AGOA, we are looking for Power Africa, and see to what extent, after the meeting with the African leaders, we'll have a new day. And the Obama administration will be able to advance the frontier of America's relations with Africa. And one of the legacies that must be remembered for all Africans, all Americans, is that Obama's father came from Kenya. And today, when we talk about legacy, what is the nature of that legacy for Kenya, for Africa, and America? That's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Niang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned about the rapid escalation of violence in Libya that could lead to widespread conflict there. In February 2011, a band of former politicians, former military officers, tribal leaders, intellectuals, members of civil society, and the business community from all over Libya met to form a government opposed to the authoritarian rule of then-Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. This coalition government, the National Transitional Council, united all factions who fought as one to rid the nation of the brutal tyrant and his adherents. Working together, they succeeded. On October 23, 2011, the council officially declared Libya to be liberated. None of this could have happened without the strong cooperation of all strata of the Libyan people. Disregarding regional, tribal, and political differences, they united to open the door to a bright new future for Libya. But unfortunately for Libya and its people, this spirit of cooperation is now being tested. And today, significant security challenges remain. Rival militia groups have escalated fighting, most recently clashing over control of Tripoli's airport. Not only does their violent struggle for power destabilize the country and impede Libya's progress towards establishing a functional democratic government, it also dishonors the spirit of the revolution to build a new state based on mutual respect and the rule of law. The United States affirms its support for Libya's democratic transition and urges the seating of the new Council of Representatives as soon as possible, said State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki. We stress the vital role Libya's Constitution Drafting Assembly plays in building the new country for which Libyans sacrificed so much during the revolution. Its work must advance without interference or violence. Libya's future will not be secured through force of arms, but only through a political accord and national dialogue that allow the state to ensure security and rule of law throughout the country. We urge all parties to engage in constructive dialogue to resolve their disputes. The United States will continue to stand with the Libyan people as they navigate these challenges and build a free, prosperous, democratic, and secure state.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.